All right. It's a Tater Report. CIUT 89.5 FM. Pardon this little sound. There we go. We're going to be talking about an important new book and a book tour, which is going to be in Toronto, Hamilton, Montreal, Ottawa. And it's the anti-sanctions tour. And the book is called Sanctions, A Wrecking Ball in a Global Economy. And it's a very apt title, in my opinion. Our guest is going to be Sarah Flounders, who is with the... She's the editor of this anthology and it's written by social justice activists, and it is published by Worldview Forum. And Sarah's with the International Action Center in New York. It's a very striking book. Everybody's going to want a copy of this. I like the title, Wrecking Book, I already mentioned, but... And it's gone through two editions. One of the first things we have to find out, I guess, is how people can acquire the book. And I'm going to tell you while we're waiting for Sarah to join us that there's going to be book launches in Toronto on April the 18th. That's tomorrow at 7 p.m. at a different book list, 779 Bathurst. And in Hamilton, it's 7 p.m. on the 19th, that's Wednesday, it might be Mickel Coffee Company, at 1008 King Street West. And in Ottawa, on Thursday, April the 20th, at 7 p.m., it's at 35 Laurel Street. Oh, yes, it's called the Happy Goat. First of all, I can't read my own handwriting. And then when it said goat, I thought, no, but turns out it is. It's a Happy Goat. 35 Laurel Street. That's Thursday, April 20th. And then on Friday, April 21st, 7 p.m. in Montreal, 4755 Avenue Van Horn. And there's a special wrinkle to the Friday event. It is available at tinural.com/wreckingballwebinar. And this is part of the anti-sanctions tour and the book launch. And I think we're joined now by Sarah Flounders herself. Are you there, Sarah?
Yes, I'm here, Phil.
It's really great to talk to you about this. Congratulations. You put together, it's titled An Anthology by Social Justice Activists, and I guess we could call it a handbook, because all the information anybody could want to know about this really aggressive practice of the U.S. to sanction practically anything that moves is we've sort of gotten used to it without thinking about why it's going on and on what legal basis. This is done, and Canada is a country that always follows suit to its great shame, and it's not changing course, so we need this book very much. Can you talk about I've been struck in recent years that it seems that the U.S. answer to everything is a sanction, and it's none of it is established in international law or... And the United Nations does exist. These sanctions are not supported by the UN, am I right?
Well, they're different kinds of sanctions, and that is one thing we were trying to do in this book with a number of different selections describing the impact on distinct countries and as a policy that is absolutely lawless and in violation of international law and the UN Charter, even when it's carried out by the United Nations, which some sanctions are. For example, the sanctions on Iraq years ago, where the famous interview where Madeleine Albright was asked, 500,000 children have died. Is it worth it? And she said, yes, we think it is. But those were United Nations sanctions, now imposed by U.S. pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And are the oldest sanctions against the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Are U.N. sanctions. Once they're voted on by U.S. veto, they are kept in place for decades and decades. So where the U.S. has been able to pressure countries to vote for sanctions at a time when Russia or China or other countries weren't exercising any vetoes in the Security Council, U.S. was able to pull it off. Mm-hmm. But most of the sanctions are U.S. sanctions. Canada does go along with every one of them. A few of the sanctions are imposed by the European Union, and the U.S. is very much part of also enforcing them. And that means using the SWIFT banking code to block every conceivable transaction. And these are a violation of international law because they do directly target civilians and civilian population, especially the most vulnerable, mm-hmm. meaning those who are old, sick, any of the, just a minute. Really, those with any pre-existing condition, when faced with no medicine, it's a death sentence.
Mm-hmm.
When faced with no x-rays, even a broken bone can be a death sentence.
Mm-hmm.
No water purification, no fertilizers, no insecticides, the most basic things that are needed in modern life mean that millions of people will be sicker and weaker, and many, many more will die. Mm-hmm. It changes the development of young children, of babies. There's no nutrition that will impact lifelong. So these are the things that are deliberate. They're U.S. policy to extract intentionally the greatest possible pain in order to force countries to comply.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, that is very often people do speak up about this. Editorials get written occasionally or letters to the editor, and people say, well, you know, they're sanctioning this country, but it's actually the poor people of that country that are suffering. But clearly, the U.S. understands that better than anyone. And that's the whole point, isn't it? They want to make them scream.
Yes, and they also want it known. It's not a secret policy. They want countries around the world to fear what this will mean. And it is applied to any country that is attempting to improve the conditions of life for their population. In other words, if there's the food subsidies that are suddenly, you know, on the table, if more money from oil or whatever the natural resource is going to be applied for raising the educational level, the U.S. is committed to imposing the most vicious form, frankly, of capitalist relations around the world, mm-hmm. even on countries that present no conceivable threat. Nicaragua is declared really a threat to U.S. security. You wonder, how is that even possible? How do they say that with a straight face?
By the way, Sarah, now that you were saying that, I remember, wasn't it Ronald Reagan who said that what is it? Nicaragua's only, I forget how many miles from Brownsville, Texas.
Right, as if there was going to be some kind of an invasion.
Yeah, he made some geographical correlation between Brownsville, Texas and the revolutionary in Nicaragua, I believe. It might have been another country.
In the same way, but Nicaragua, or if you look at Cuba, these countries are a threat. When they make a dramatic change in the conditions of life for their population. That is what U.S. corporations fear will catch on. and they would rather starve a country down than allow it to succeed in full free education, free health care. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a bad example to them. That's a dangerous example. Mm-hmm. And so they impose policies to really send an economy into chaos, hyperinflation, shortages. And they know that for many people, they will blame the government that is unable to provide, that this will create dissension. And the sanctions don't operate alone. Always with them come coup attempts really to destabilize, to undermine, to use all sorts of U.S.-funded NGOs to operate as an opposition force. The sanctions are one part of a policy that come with efforts to invade, intervene, sabotage an economy. They're never used alone.
We're speaking to Sarah Flounders. She is the editor of Sanctions, A Wrecking Ball in a Global Economy, an anthology of social justice activists, a project of the Sanctions Kill campaign. By the way, this is the second edition, Sarah. Is there an online site, or how do people get this book?
Well, it's easy to order, and also the books will be available at the different events. That's what's so exciting, that it's in Canada in four cities. There are people meeting, talking, and with copies of the book. Mm-hmm. It's also available. You can order an EPUB or a PDF of the book. Mm-hmm. And so they'll have copies of the book. Now, that's at iacenter.org/sanctions-book, where you can order it.
Very good.
People who are at the event, if they sign up, they can, as I say, get the PDF or pick up a book there. Because of shipping right now, it's a bit hard for us to, price-wise, mm-hmm. mail the books individually to Canada. So there's a bulk mailing. That's why I say people can pick it up at these events.
I'm very impressed with the number of people let's just say in principle from so many different directions who've taken up the subject of your book. And it is endorsed by Scott Ritter, who's a political military analyst, former U.S. Marine officer, and United Nations weapons inspector. And he said the following. Sanctions, A Wrecking Ball in the Global Economy, I observed firsthand from 1991 to 2002 the inhumanity and ineffectiveness of U.S.-led sanctions targeting Iraq. I can say without fear of contradiction that the publication of Sanctions, A Wrecking Ball in the Global Economy, provides a much-needed source of historical and current information about the nefarious reality of America's go-to policy of choice, sanctions. With U.S.-led sanctions on Russia boomeranging back to harm the sanctioning parties more than the sanctioned, it is critical that the public at large get involved in the kind of informed debate, discussion, and dialogue necessary to effect change on the part of those who continue to view sanctions as a viable policy option. This book serves as an invaluable resource in that effort. And that's Scott Ritter. That's powerful stuff. And he touches on something which I know you have in your writing, I think, and in the introduction to the book. This, the U.S. Ability to threaten and menace and sanction, of course, to a degree, is, as you talked about earlier, it's to put fear into smaller developing countries, cause others to be fearful of crossing U.S. hegemony or interest. But on the other hand, there is a change going on, and you've noted that.
Yeah.
The grip of the U.S. seems to be slowly slipping, and I suppose we need to talk about China-Russia there. But talk about where we are in the, I guess, expression of well, tipping point in U.S. power.
It is a new day, and it is galloping at us so fast, it's kind of stunning what's happening, because a weapon used and overused again and again, more than 40 countries are under sanctions, a third of the world population. But the U.S. effort to impose the sanctions on Russia, which impacted grain and fuel and fertilizer and everything needed by countries of the global south, there was a refusal to go along with the sanctions. And the ability instead to trade among themselves, and most important was China's refusal to go along, because this is an economy who China is the largest trading country now for 120 countries around the world. The U.S. is ebbing back. No longer is it the big provider, producer. And the dollar is losing its power for that reason also. But now, and once China said no, they weren't going along, they would continue trade. Of course, all of the BRICS countries did also. India, that was very important. South Africa, Brazil. Mm-hmm. Then all the countries of Africa in one way or another, even if they said it politely, said that they didn't understand. These weren't sanctions that they had anything to do with. They didn't vote for them. They wouldn't apply them. Countries found that there were ways that they could trade among themselves. That's new. And it means that the almighty dollar is no longer all-powerful, the only currency in which oil and grain and so on could be traded in. Those days are past. And I don't think the U.S. has really thought about the implications of that. They continue to strut and act in great arrogance, as if they're the only ones who can dare call the shots. They're using more and more military measures in threatening China and very dangerous buildup in the South China Sea. Mm. The war, certainly, which is really a U.S.-NATO war against Russia. They're doubling down on that, sending more and more equipment. So they're ignoring what is the reality happening on the ground, and that is the majority of the countries around the world are refusing to go along with U.S. sanctions, and new forms of trade and currency and exchange are opening up. And that's a very exciting thing. It's also a very dangerous moment because U.S. empire, U.S. imperialism refuses to accept this new reality. And the only thing they have to trade, frankly, are weapons. That's a dangerous moment.
Yeah, and even the weapons game doesn't seem to be working the way it did. I mean, Saudi Arabia was used to just buy weapons and do as they're told, and now we have this, frankly, shocking, I think it was, wake-up moment. Saudi Arabia, and Iran go to Beijing to have a meeting under the auspices of the Chinese government, and they come away and say, thank you very much. We're now going to get along.
That's huge, because Saudi Arabia, this is the reactionary feudal regime for sure. It has been a bastion of U.S. power in the region for a couple of generations.
But didn't they pay for the attack on Syria, which the U.S. organized? They were making the Saudis pay for them.
That's right. And the Saudis were more than willing to. But now they see they have other options, and they also understand the U.S. is an oil exporter, so the U.S. is actually a competitor now. Mm-hmm. So it's in U.S. interest for there to be war between Saudi Arabia and Iran to shut down the Straits of Hormuz. Yes, they can see that's in U.S. interest, but not in their interest. Mm-hmm. So they're open to a new relationship with Iran, and that is a really stunning development in terms of everything happening in the Middle East and among the Gulf states. This is
yes, I mean, among the issues talked about, by the way, it is in there, it'll probably have to update it, but there's the war in Yemen, which the Americans and the British were providing intelligence and weapons to attack the poorest country, using the richest in the Middle East. And now there's a danger of peace breaking out, and they are biting their nails.
They actually, the U.S. and the British kept this war going all these years. It was a U.S. naval blockade on Yemen that was the greatest hardship in terms of the Yemeni struggle. That was imposed by the U.S. Saudi weapons are all operated with U.S. contractors sitting next to every Saudi military. Mm-hmm. And now all of that is changing. And it's changing for Syria also. That's a big development, the idea of Syria, you know, Assad going to Saudi Arabia. Mm. That's huge. These are big, big changes that are happening.
They're already agreeing to have flights between the capitals, and they are opening the embassies.
That's right.
And the Arab League is going to be meeting, and the assumption is that Syria will be there.
This is a huge big, big change. And it really means the collapse of U.S. war plans, which are based on keeping countries utterly divided at each other's throats. That's also what sanctions do. It breaks trade in a whole region. And the only policy that the U.S. has is divide and rule, weapons and more weapons, make wars. And suddenly, countries around the world are looking at that and saying, maybe this isn't in our own self-interest, frankly.
Yeah.
That's a big change. Now, will sanctions continue to work as a wrecking ball? At this point, U.S. policymakers, the think tanks, the political establishment here, is more than willing to wreck the global economy if it's not going in their way. And that is, look what they did to the European Union. The EU had a larger trade with Russia than with the United States. But yes, they went along with the sanction, thinking yes, it'll bring down, they have a chance to overturn not only the government in Russia, but it would be a free-for-all again, as it was in the 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, it didn't turn out that way. And it has become disastrous for the European Union. The very sanctions that they voted for have created great hardships for the population. And as we can see in France in these incredible demonstrations, population isn't going along with it.
No, including here, by the way. I mean, actually, even you know, when polls are taken, you don't actually find enthusiasm for war or confrontation. The politicians, yes, but actually the population isn't showing enthusiasm. It's certainly not in Europe.
That's right.
And we have, I'm going to get your thoughts on this development of the strange arrival in Beijing of the president of France, together with the leader of the European Union, von Leyen. And some people speculate that they were watching each other. But the president of France used a phrase which no one in Canada wants to hear, which is, we should not be vassals of the U.S. And that's a verboten word here, because somebody did say it once, and everybody said, don't say that again, because we're vassals. But what did you make? There was even a strange configuration. You must have seen the pictures. Von Leyen was three feet from President Xi, and President Macron stood shoulder to shoulder with him for the photograph. And as you know, people who study photographs say, what was that all about? But anyway, what do you make of the visit?
Well, Macron, he's like good at talking the talk and not carrying through. You know, there were many visits to Russia where he seemed to always have a peace plan in his back pocket. But went along with all the sanctions. So it's hard to know if what he says on the very day after he left, French aircraft carrier sailed through the Straits of Taiwan. Macron said, oh, don't take that seriously. It's just a routine trip. Mm-hmm. I don't know. And at the same time, he is trying to impose drastic cuts on the French working class, and they're not going to accept it. So
yes, but strikingly, the French working class leaders agree with him about let's not be a vassal.
That's right.
All the left leaders that I've seen have said, well, you're late to the party. Of course we should not be a vassal, and we shouldn't be part of this U.S. operation.
Right, right. So anyway, I can't say I have any trust for Macron. It's important he went. I think it's even more exciting for Lula of Brazil's trip with more than 100 business people, Brazilian business people and whatnot, to China, because those are real deals that are being made. Also, actually, there may be ways in which the European Union begins to stand up to U.S. demands, because clearly the United States wants to instigate a war with China.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing so by imposing the most dangerous militarization in Japan, which has more than doubled its military budget, Korea, and the Philippines. In Guam, building new airways and runways and bases there. A little tiny Guam where there are already 54 U.S. bases.
And the Guamanians have never appreciated their presence, and that's always forgotten about. Actually, I guess Guam is legally considered U.S. territory in some form.
That's right, and in an outrageous way. So will the European Union really stand up to the U.S., or will they go along again? That's unclear. It certainly is in their interest. The European Union has more trade with China than they do with the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
and far more profitable trade with China than they do with the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So sanctions for them would be a death knell of their economy. It's already been seriously, seriously damaged by the sanctions they voted for on Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So if they go along with any of these actions against China, they'll surely pay the price. But it does show how dangerous the world is becoming, how what we need is a real evaluation of this. The book was an effort to show this is a weapon, not just a bland word, and to explain how it works and what the implication is on different countries, and also how countries have resisted and survived.
Mm-hmm.
Because when sanctions are imposed, there's either an immediate surrender, or a country has to reorganize its economy in order to just provide for its population. Now, today, Nicaragua is more than 90% food self-sufficient. That's a huge thing.
Mm-hmm.
We could look at a whole number of countries that have been able to, in desperate ways, reorganize their economies. But now, as we're talking about, bigger things are happening on a world scale. They're trading with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Not just can you have a full meal, but can you have a modern, healthy, and developed life for the future and for the children?
Mm-hmm.
Will there be everything from computer parts to mass transit available? Can you provide sanitation and sewage and, you know, running water in homes? Can you build new housing and highways and rail lines? Now, this is the kind of thing which is really beginning to happen, and the U.S. isn't offering any of it. They will sell weapons, but
yes,
the Belt and Road Initiative, they can't match if they wanted to. It's not the way the economy here is oriented.
Yes.
We can't build it here, let alone for other countries. We can't build a rail line anywhere.
Yeah, I'll go into that a little more in just a moment. I just want to remind everybody, this is Sarah Flounders. She's the editor of the book, Sanctions, A Wrecking Ball in a Global Economy. And there's an anti-sanctions tour for the book. And it is speakers are Halye Dutagli, and she is a professor at Carleton University. John Philpott, who is an international law expert, and Judy Bellow, who is the editor of the United National Anti-War Coalition blog. And the first of the meetings, public meetings, can be Toronto tomorrow, April the 18th, 7 p.m., at a different book list, and that's at 779 Bathurst Street. So 7 p.m. tomorrow. 779 Bathurst, and on the 19th in Hamilton at 7 p.m., that's a Wednesday, at the Mickle Coffee Company, 1008 King Street West, and in Ottawa on Thursday, April the 20th, 7 p.m., at the Happy Goat, 35 Laurel Street, and on the 21st, there'll be a meeting, public meeting for the book launch, Montreal, Friday, April 21, 7 p.m., 4755 Avenue Van Horn. And this is going to be one where you can attend by Zoom. So you go to tinural.com/wreckingballwebinar. And Sarah, I want to mention Biden, we seem to have this problem. I wonder if people still suffer from it, because there seems to be growing cynicism about the U.S. power and the any notion that there is any great difference of opinion amongst the people who run the United States, because, like we talked about Syria, and Obama was, there might have already been some types of, but Obama brought sanctions. Then he's followed Trump has sanctions, the same, and Biden. Biden was here to speak to the Canadian Parliament, and he really, sort of two things came out of that. And in terms of his impression, he was very, very confident, he said, about, you know, the U.S. was going to prevail, and that Canada was always going to be with the United States. It was his vocabulary, and I noticed it too. It is speech at the before Congress. It has a kind of a slight desperate sound to it. He was calling out by name the president of China, saying who would want to be in his shoes. And actually, if you and I were to take a poll around the world, people would say who would want to be in Biden's shoes, right? And this Nord Stream thing, where New York Times says maybe it's better we don't know what happened. And that seems like a part and parcel of the sanction process. It's instead of a sanction, he just simply blew up a pipeline, which should really frighten everybody, including the Germans and the French.
Yeah, they definitely blew up the pipeline, and that's been shown again and again. And it shows that they are willing to do more and more desperate things and be absolutely lawless about it. And I think that's what we need to know in terms of who's imposing these policies. And it's both Democrats and Republicans. They are united. A lot of these sanctions go through literally on a voice vote, a hand raise. No one speaks against it. And there's another country where they can't get the most basic things.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to look at what's happening with U.S. imperialism as a system trying to impose its complete dominance around the world, and finding that the world has in many ways moved on, that there are other options, and that billions, literally, of people are more than anxious to take those other options.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is still a real block of not only the U.S., but the G7 countries. who are in one way or another still determined to pursue their dominance of the world, the global economy. It will pull them all down. And I think for Canada, right, Biden's trying to convince people who are beginning to think, this is the best we should be doing, mm-hmm. even for our own people. And do we have an obligation around the world? Is the only policy to starve countries down, to initiate wars, to sell weapons?
Mm-hmm.
This is, you know, really desperate choices. And it comes out of the very system that is based on ruthless competition, where you're always trying to literally defeat and destroy your opponents.
Yeah. By the way, you know, the Chinese use a term which we should repeat often, because what the U.S. response is really and exposes them. China says, we're actually not your adversary. We're not interested in any conflict with you. We don't actually have conflicts with anybody else. And if we do, we work on solving it through diplomacy. But and we believe in win-win. But you believe in win-lose, which is, you know, it's a confession of the kind of monopolistic, aggressive, empire-thinking state. And, you know, that's sobering. This conflict is interesting what is done with the language. The Chinese say win-win. You cannot hear an American leader who would utter those terms.
No, here in the U.S., it would be considered almost laughable. It goes against the very grain. This is a country built on the genocide of the indigenous people and on the enslavement of African people. From its very DNA, mm-hmm. it is about conquest. And it has continued in that way, whether it's the Monroe Doctrine or in its new form today, which are what the sanctions are, and which is what the expansion of NATO is. It is endless war in order to impose corporate dominance. And the corporations have a real problem now,
mm-hmm.
Because it's a system that has to be constantly expanding or it's dying,
mm-hmm.
and now it is truly dying system. So every CEO feels a threat right now.
Yes, has to be a winner. It has to be.
Yeah, that's how they see it.
I want to ask about this. The what you laid out there is a U.S. history, which I see more and more people saying U.S. history is very peculiar. As you know, although it reflects part of the concept of the old British empire, but there's in building the empire, a lot of them were pirates, and there's a lot of theft that goes on now, right? I mean, they freeze a country's assets, and they did it here in Canada. They take all the assets that are in there under their power to take by the banks, and then give it to themselves or their friends or whoever they feel like giving it to. I mean, we're actually pirates in that sense in Washington and Ottawa, right?
Completely. I mean, when you look at simply a theft of Venezuela's assets, its largest corporation, oil corporation, when you look at what was done to Libya, were literally not only their assets stolen, the country bombed to destruction, the leader assassinated, someone a year before that they had declared man of the year and, you know,
mm-hmm.
and had nothing but praise for, encouraging complete disarmament in Libya and then complete destruction. So they're not against looting a whole country, making off, literally disappearing.
They've taken Afghanistan's assets, right? I mean, this is a country flat on its back from U.S. occupation and bombing, and now they take whatever they had in the bank, you know, and are refusing to give it back.
Refusing to give it back, or to allow even the UN to provide the very meager programs that the United Nations is capable of. And we saw this in Syria in terms of the earthquake. Now, the United Nations does have warehouses chock-a-block full of all kinds of tents and field hospitals and water and sanitation and cots and blankets and whatnot for natural disasters. And yet, that could not be provided to Syria after a devastating earthquake.
Yeah, could you explain that? Because that's a very important topic, certainly here in Canada. People say, oh, no, we lifted the, you know, we're providing humanitarian. We're not, we understand there was an earthquake. So, but that isn't true.
Right, it was absolutely not true. And they even announced that they were going to lift the ability to send money. But for organizations attempting to, it turned out to be so complicated to send even a few dollars. I mean, we're talking about in the meager thousands when there was already easy to dispense, as I say, all that would be needed in terms of from earth movers to tents to blankets to food rations. And none of that was opened up. So sometimes they'll put out a press release, and we could see this also during COVID, that any of the sanctioned countries received no vaccines. Most of the global south received very, very minimal and usually out-of-date and almost expired vaccines. Why is that? Mm-hmm. There's a feeling that there is no collective obligation, and at the same time, China and Russia and Cuba and Iran were developing their own vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
Although they had a real problem. I mean, here's Cuba, who's done so much work in the field of medicine, and they provide more doctors and medical technicians in Africa than the World Health Organization.
That's
pretty stunning.
By the way, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Their own vaccine, but they didn't have syringes to provide the jab to their own population. And that took actually a campaign from outside Cuba, a solidarity campaign, just to provide syringes. So you can see there's this constant intentional imposing of inequality, hardships, everything that could create dissension internally.
Mm-hmm.
Shortages, hyperinflation, all of that. It's not an accidental policy. This is the way the empire works.
And they do it in some cases in absolute isolation from the world. And Exhibit A being Cuba, where if there's one thing there's almost world unanimity on, is lifting the blockade. Since 1959, I guess.
Since 59.
And your organization, of course, the great Ramsey Clark, and by the way, the other individual that you cite as inspiration for your book, Miguel Descoto, worked very hard on this. But 90 miles from the United States is a country that they literally go crazy if you mention its name.
Right.
Why is that?
Because they are threatened by the example of what can be provided. And we shouldn't lose sight of that examples inspire others to act. So the idea that
clearly does.
Cuba was doing could catch fire in Latin America, well, that was a very dangerous concept. So make it just as harsh as you can for Cuba. Later for Venezuela, for Nicaragua, and they threaten every other
country. Mexico. I mean, we have the president of Mexico saying he's going to make his personal crusade to lift the blockade. He, entirely separate from his party and politics, he says that's what he wants to do.
I do hope he keeps pushing on it because he knows he speaks for the population where there's no support at all for the blockade the sanctions on Cuba. So he's doing a popular political thing. I do hope he keeps it as his real campaign. It needs to be. But throughout, you know, throughout the world, these threats come again and again. It's the way they're used to doing business, getting their way. And I think having an understanding of how this works and how it is a whole strategy is very helpful for people to see in a holistic way. Sometimes there are support groups working very hard on one struggle, solidarity with one country or another, and they might not be thinking at all about sanctions on Zimbabwe or on Sudan or Ethiopia because they might be focused in another area. So we're trying to say, no, this is, let's look at each of these countries and demand an end to the intentional starving down and the sanctions policy. And it is only one step because it's also all the people involved in this are against U.S. wars one after the other, mm-hmm. against the expansion of NATO for sure. And the speakers that you listed have really been in the forefront. I think Ken Stone is also very much part of this and one of the
speakers. Yes, one of the chapters in the book is the Hamilton Coalition Against the War.
That's right. And they've really done amazing things in putting out every time an up-to-the-minute response, mm-hmm. which is picked up by others. I mean, sometimes we don't think how you put out one statement and others use that as the basis, and it becomes an example of what's possible. So some of those resolutions, the idea of including them in the petitions is to show that there's a lot of resources out there, things we can utilize, and groups that think about this deeply and worry about every word in drafting the mm-hmm. statement.
Yes.
There's also, by the way, there's a whole effort at building an international tribunal on mm-hmm. sanctions. And folks at these events are going to hear about that also, to look at the different countries and to really talk about the role of the U.S. in violating international law and the U.N. Charter, which says regardless, even in time of war, mm-hmm. the civilian population must be protected. Nothing can be done that could impact the civilians. And here's a weapon that is determined to wreak havoc on the most defenseless civilians.
Mm-hmm. It is, again, it's like a great handbook, and it's been endorsed by Joe Lombardo, the coordinator of the United Nations National Anti-War Coalition, Alice Slater, Board of World Beyond War, Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power and Space, and the UN NGO representative of Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, Margaret Kimberly, the executive editor of Black Agenda Report, a wonderful publication, and David Swanson, executive director of World Beyond War. Sarah, you guys really have created an essential book, and I'm glad that it's been done. I'm glad we're going to have this tour of Canada, and there's going to be meetings in Toronto, Hamilton, Montreal, and Ottawa, and following on our interview, I'm going to be talking about those dates and places again. And we just thank you very, very much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much, Phil, really, for your constant program, but for your support on this tour. And I do want to thank those who are speaking out on it, who are, really had everything to do. Judy Bellow, the whole putting this in book form, which is a mm-hmm. huge task.
And she's one of the speakers at the event.
That's right.
So we look forward to seeing her.
Has been to Syria and to Iran and really addressed this for years. So these are folks who are really doers along with writers and speakers. Mm-hmm. Certainly also true with John Philpott, who particularly the U.S. lawless policy in Africa. He has charted for years of sanctions and coup attempts and so on. So, and as a lawyer, as an international lawyer, he's followed this in some detail.
Yeah.
And also, you know, when you look at cases like the Alex Saab, Venezuelan diplomat,
yes,
trying to provide food and medicine for the Venezuelan people, and instead is literally plucked out of the sky.
Of course, punished for providing humanitarian assistance.
That's right.
The crime of crimes.
Yeah, and to hell with diplomatic immunity, and he's a diplomat, there's no doubt about it, even by U.S. standards. But so you can see how lawless the policy becomes. The more they try to justify it, the more lawless they are willing,
yes,
to take one step after another.
Yes, that was something I thought President Assad put his finger on when he said, the United States, when you deal with them, it's a law of the jungle.
Yes. Yeah.
Because they will stop at nothing. Well, again, Sarah, thank you very, very much. We're looking forward to this great tour.
Great. All right. I'm looking forward to hearing about it. Okay.
All
take
right.
care.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Bye. This Taylor Report, and just to tell you again, this is it's the anti-sanctions tour from book launch, and the book is titled Sanctions, a Wrecking Ball in a Global Economy. And the speakers are Haleya Dutagi, she is a professor of law at Carleton University, John Philpott, international law expert, Judy Bellow, editor of the United National Anti-War Coalition blog, and in Toronto tomorrow, 7 p.m., at a different book list. You have to get into a new mode now. We're actually having public events. People are gathering in together. It's been quite a while. I think we're out of the habit. So that's at 7 p.m. tomorrow, April 18, a different book list, 779 Bathurst. And Hamilton, 7 o'clock, April the 19th, Wednesday. And it's the Mikkel Coffee Company, 1008 King Street West. And in Ottawa on Thursday, April 20 at 7 o'clock at the Happy Goat at 35 Laurel Street. And Montreal on Friday, April the 21st at 7 p.m., 4755 Avenue Van Horn, 10-year-old, now I'm saying this, 10yearold.com/wreckingball webinar. That is available if you go to that site. That'll be available by, I guess we're going to use the word Zoom, but you can attend and see what's going on.